Hi, everyone. This is Mark Malatesta with thebestsellingauthor.com and Literary Agent Undercover, helping authors of all genres, fiction, nonfiction, and children's books, write, publish, and promote their work. This interview will be approximately 60 minutes. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the writer who went undercover and became a literary agent to find out how to get my own books published. An agent is someone who gets authors' book deals with traditional publishers like Random House. After running a literary agency for approximately 5 years, I then served as the marketing and licensing manager for Blue Mountain Arts. That's the book and gift publisher that invented e-cards or e-greetings and later sold their e-card division for close to $1 billion. Today, I'm an author coach and consultant who's helped hundreds of authors get offers from literary agents and or traditional publishers, and I love promoting my authors. They've gotten six-figure book deals and advances with publishers such as Random House, Simon & Schuster, Thomas Nelson. They've been on the New York Times bestseller list, had their work picked up for TV, stage, and feature film with companies like Paramount Pictures, DreamWorks, Lionsgate, and HBO Max. They won countless awards, and they've had their work licensed in more than 40 countries, resulting in millions of books sold. Who knows? You might be next. If you believe your book has bestseller or commercial potential, visit our website at thebestsellingauthor.com, primarily designed for authors who want to get a traditional publisher such as Random House. We offer a wide range of products and services such as audio interviews like this, articles, one of the most popular literary agent directories, and one-on-one author coaching and consulting. Again, learn more at thebestsellingauthor.com. Now, let me introduce today's special guest. John Stansifer is the author of No Bullet Got Me Yet, The Relentless Faith of Father Capon, published in hardcover by Hanover Square Press, an imprint of HarperCollins. The book chronicles the story of the most decorated chaplain in U.S. military history and his path to sainthood in the Roman Catholic Church. No man in the United States has ever received this honor. John is represented by Mel Berger with William Morris Endeavor Entertainment. Trimax Media has acquired the film rights to the book with Stephen Campanelli, who's worked with Clint Eastwood on many films, to direct. HarperCollins is now planning a second edition of the book with a movie tie-in. They pushed back the release date to accommodate a larger press run and more time for marketing. Jim DeFelice, co-author of American Sniper, which Campanelli worked on with Eastwood, says, Father Capon's story is one of the great war stories of all time, combining courage under fire, faith, and tremendous sacrifice and endurance. John Stansifer was born to tell it. That was part of the quote. Father Capon, a humble priest, went far beyond the call of duty during World War II and the Korean War. Often found with combat medics on the front lines, unarmed, ministering to the wounded, and known for his intense devotion to the soldiers whom he called my boys, Capon was awarded a Medal of Honor, the Distinguished Service Cross, and the Legion of Merit. John spent years interviewing veterans and ex-POWs to research and write this book. Coupled with interviews, self-published war experiences, as well as material from the National Archives, and rare access to thousands of unseen documents, No Bullet Got Me Yet unveils the most complete history of the life of Father Capon as related by his friends, family, and fellow soldiers, as well as in his own words from numerous letters he wrote. So welcome, John.
Welcome. Happy to be here.
Oh, good. It's been a long road. I know you're going to talk about that, but a long journey that ended with a wonderful destination.
Absolutely. It's unbelievable.
All right. So let's dive in first to the manuscript. I know I told people briefly what the book's about, but why don't you, author, I feel always can do a little bit better than me, so maybe a lot better than me. Please take a few minutes. Just tell everyone more about the story, since I know everybody listening is going to want your advice for writers, but many people also take a personal interest in the book and want to read it, buy it, may hopefully review it. So talk a little bit more about the story.
Absolutely. First and foremost, it's a biography of Emil Capon, who is better known as Father Capon. He was a small town priest in Pilsen, Kansas, and that is a very small town, no stoplights, et cetera. And like a lot of people, when the bombing of Pearl Harbor happened in 1941, he was immediately wanted to serve his country, and he was already ordained as a priest. So in order to become a chaplain, he had to get permission from his bishop, who wouldn't give it to him at first, because we think he was trying to protect him, and not because a lot of chaplains actually were getting killed. So he became an auxiliary chaplain in Kansas for a couple of years. And then he finally wrote his bishop and said, "I can't take it anymore. I feel God is calling me to serve my country over the local parish." And his bishop finally agreed to let him go to chaplain school in 1945. And then he was commissioned a captain and served in the CBI theater, China, Burma, and India in 1945 and 46. And then after the war, he got a master's degree in education at Catholic University. And then the rise of communism in the late 40s really alarmed him, and he rejoined the military, was sent to Japan, and while there, the Korean War broke out, and he once again became a chaplain in the 1st Cavalry Division. And the stories of what he went through, relentless combat from one tip of Korea to the next, are unprecedented stories. And he wrote a lot of letters in his free time telling his folks back home what was going on, and his letters are incredible. And I must say, his last letter home, he wrote, "No bullet got me yet, though a machine gunner sprayed us with bullets, but the prayers of our loved ones helped us escape." And when I read that, I knew "No Bullet Got Me Yet" was going to be the title of the book, because to me it represents a brave philosophy of the soldier that keeps soldiering on. As long as you don't kill him, he's going to keep going.
And his faith is important.
Absolutely. And that's why it's important to explain the title of the book, because it's kind of a simple kind of, I would call it a Kansas phrase, maybe even, "No bullet got me yet." And to me, that's one of the driving philosophies or phrases that makes me so proud to be involved in this and inspired by Father Capon. And I know that it's going to inspire a lot of other people. And he's already been inspiring thousands and thousands of lives over the years.
Did your agent or the publisher push back or question the title in any way, or they just accept it? Because usually they'll want to change it.
No serious discussion came on that.
Oh, you didn't have to fight for that. Good.
On certain things I can be pretty forceful on, and I was, because of the thought that went into it beforehand, because I feel anointed by Capon to tell this story, as weird as that sounds. So I always feel like I'm speaking on his behalf, never for myself. It's not about my ego. It's about what Capon would have appreciated being told about him, and certainly a lot of the truth. So they accepted the title right away. And the other thing that you usually argue, I guess, with publishers on is the cover of the book.
Yeah.
And I knew that the photo of him holding the broken pipe
is
which
money.
You can't see very well in black and white, so I had it colorized, and it came out perfect.
Right.
And I fought with them for 7 months to get that cover on there, because they were concerned that maybe somebody held a copyright on it, but which they didn't. It's in the public domain. And at one point they suggested, "Well, do you have another picture for the cover?" I said, no way. That is the cover of the book. It goes with the title, "No Bullet Got Me Yet." He's holding a broken pipe just when you look at the cover, and you can see medic's tape wrapped on it, because that pipe was shot out of his mouth by a sniper's bullet.
Oh, man.
It's perfect. When you understand the story of the sniper bullet and the title, you'll know that that's the cover. And,
right.
I stuck with it.
Yeah. And I love it. I mean, I know this will sound strange until people look at it, but it's like, it's friendly and it's a charming photo, even though it's in the middle of all that. Right.
Oh,
and
he's grinning ear to ear in the middle of a war. That's
right. And it doesn't scream at the reader, "Oh, this is a super religious, serious book." Either.
Absolutely. He looks like he's saying, "You missed me. You missed me."
Right. Right. Like right.
He got shot at probably 10,000 times during the war. He went through a lot of combat.
All right, so now let's talk about the journey a little bit. I'm going to do a little bit of wind-up on this because you've been down a long road. So I just want to start at the end of when things started getting good. So you've been querying, and now you have what seems like maybe serious interest, and how that turns into an offer. And so just the short story of like how that happened, and then that turned into you going with Mel, and how that turned into publisher interest, and what you've done to celebrate, if anything, along the way, all the way up to the now where we have the movie stuff going on, whatever you're comfortable with or allowed to say about that.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, I know exactly when the journey started, and that's April 11th, 2013. I literally turned on the TV, and his Medal of Honor ceremony was airing live at the time, and I saw the whole thing.
Wow.
My jaw was on the floor. President Obama told his story. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. It was absolutely incredible. I was floored. And then when I heard he was from Kansas, my home state, I was even more intrigued. I knew immediately that I was going to write a movie about him, and it was going to be bigger than myself. I actually said that out loud. I mean, who talks like that? It's going to be bigger than myself. That's why I say I feel I was anointed to tell the story.
Right.
So I first wrote a biopic, true story, Korean War movie screenplay about him called Father Capone's Valley. Immediately after learning who he was and returning to Kansas and starting my research, and I've pitched many scripts over the years, expensive and not, and been optioned many times but never had anything made. So this was 2014 moving forward, and it was quite apparent, because Capone wasn't famous enough, I wasn't going to find a budget for such a huge war movie. So since I'd already started all this research, my father passed away, I received some inheritance, and I actually moved to Wichita, Kansas, where my parents and grandparents are from, to collect further research from the Father Capone Guild and the Catholic Diocese of Wichita, and they provided me everything. It was thousands of documents, more than enough to write a book. And they basically asked me, well, why don't you write a biography on him? And I thought, this is one of the greatest stories I've ever heard. Of course I'll do it. But this was for free. I had no book deal.
Right.
So I invested a lot of money in the travel and time period. And I did come up with a book proposal and had just met you. The initial book proposal was way too long. But I really didn't have anybody to submit it to, because editors would say, well, wait till Capone becomes canonized, and then we're interested in it. And I thought, well, his story is already incredible now. We don't need to add on to it.
Right.
Whatever. So like the script, then I moved to Florida and tried to finish the book, and did finish a book, about 500 pages. But again, even working with you, we had no way to get it to an editor that would care, because his name just wasn't big enough. And my name certainly was nothing. That all changed in March of 2021. His remains were discovered and positively identified through DNA testing. He had been at the Punchbowl Hawaii National Cemetery since 1954 and was buried in a unmarked grave, or a grave marked X217 or whatever in Hawaii. And they didn't DNA test him until 2019. So in 2021, when his remains were positively identified, he had been MIA for over 70 years. That's unbelievable.
Wow.
And you can imagine the family, who never thought they would see him again,
right,
reacting to this news. Then an old man in a doctor's office in Tampa, Florida, was waiting in the waiting room, and he saw a magazine with Father Capone's picture on the cover. And there was a story about his remains being positively identified. He took the magazine into the doctor's office, and when he went home, he called the Catholic Diocese of Wichita, and he told them, I'm the one that buried Father Capone in the POW camp. Unbelievable. He had never connected with a Capone story since the Korean War, and as an old man in his 90s,
in the doctor's office,
I'm the one that buried Capone. So they interviewed him extensively, and he gave testimony to declare that he was martyred by the Chinese And in a, behind the death house at this POW camp, there was a thousand sets of a thousand bodies in both, basically in a mass grave. Well, these POWs knew that Father Capone was special, and this guy went out of his way to bury him deep and separately from the others, so that when he was disinterred in 1954 by an excavation team and taken to Japan and then to Hawaii for identification, they didn't have DNA at the time. So when they did identify him, his remains were 95% intact, which is unbelievable. So they had a funeral service for him in Wichita, Kansas, and they packed a hockey arena. 10,000 people attended. It was live streamed on TV. More national news coverage.
And wasn't that when, like, around the time that we were starting to pitch agents?
That's when you and I decided to, because Mel Berger had said, wait until after his funeral before submitting when it would make more national news.
So right, more media.
We had already crafted the query letter to get Mel Berger's attention before the funeral. That's when he said yes. But he didn't want to send out the book proposal until it was tweaked a little bit. So we worked on that. And the book proposal goes into a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, just how big the story is, and thus the market for the story is there. So Mel Berger was patient, and our first book proposal that went out was pitched more as an oral history rather than a narrative nonfiction. And this is very important for your listeners to understand. Nobody wanted something called an oral history. It was dead. But a couple of people, including the current editor, said, can you change it to more narrative nonfiction? Then we'll be interested. So I had already written in that style before. I just thought I was pitching it differently. So I did a quick rewrite within a few days. I mean, I already knew all the stories. I was like, sure, I'm just going to change the chapters up here and make it more traditional and not call it an oral history, even though it's partly that anyway. But as a genre, it doesn't appeal to somebody, especially on somebody that's not as famous. So with the new proposal, I would say within days, we had a bidding war between multiple publishers within Random House and HarperCollins. One of them even said that I would get a higher advance if Capone gets canonized, like they're going to put Vegas odds on when he gets canonized.
Like make it contingent on that, right?
Contingent, and we both laughed at that. I said, no way, man.
Yeah, no thanks.
So we ended up with HarperCollins in what I can only describe as a record advance for an unpublished first-time author that's not a celebrity. And my marketing plan in the book proposal was so dynamite, appealing to the faith-based market and the veteran war heroes and military market, that the advance became 2 to 3 times. And that's when I knew that they knew that this was a big story.
Right. Yeah, and we got 3 things. We got general audience, we've got faith audience, and we've got military audience. It's a lot.
That happened all because the power of Capone's story. It's as simple as that. This book, in conjunction with the movie or even without the movie, we have the very real possibility, in conjunction with the church, to make Father Capone a household name, and that's worldwide. And by the way, I'm actually expecting my first copy of the book tomorrow. Been quite a journey. I would have had it sooner, but of course they sent it ground shipping instead of FedEx.
Right. The galley, the review copy.
Yeah. Right. You were asking about what kind of celebration I've been having with me and my girlfriend. And I have to say, the process has taken, you know, longer than I expected, with the dates changing on the release. But every day has been a celebration, because basically I could quit my day job and say that I'm a professional writer. I mean, that's been a dream since, you know, for years, obviously. And the story is so powerful and the potential for success is so great that I can write whatever I want going into the future.
Right.
And then to be doubly blessed with a movie in the making, possibly in production very soon, I feel like there's no time to celebrate. Like I'm stepping into my real job now. I'm the producer and the sole credited screenwriter on the movie, and obviously the author of this book, both ongoing at the same time. It's obviously my phone is blowing up and I'm getting a lot of details, but I feel an obligation to Father Capon, the responsibility to do this right. If I can't do it right, I wouldn't do it at all.
Right. So we talked about when you got the idea for the book. Is there anything you want to talk about, like your writing previously, like other things you wrote that you think maybe help shape you as a writer, or, you know, when you thought you might be a writer that way?
First and foremost, I got to say, I've written a lot of screenplays, serious biopics, a lot of research, and I never got them through production. I had interest, but nothing. I never had a big agent. Right. Couldn't break through. And despite all these screenplays for years that I, you know, have, and I wrote them out by hand, by the way, on LegalPad before typing them in the computer. I took on Father Capon's Valley in 2013, a long time ago, more than 10 years ago. And I did it again. It's called a spec screenplay, where you're writing on the speculation that you'll sell it. And I did it again because I knew the power of the story was so great that I could do it. And here's the thing that I look back on all my screenwriting and other writing that I did before. I view that as the experience given to me in order to write the Father Capon's Valley screenplay,
right,
and ultimately the book. So I don't look back with regret at all those scripts that didn't get made, which I like a lot of them still. And now the potential is for several of them to get made because of the Capon movies.
Some of those might get made, right?
So I like to think that writing was not in vain. I don't want to die an unknown, unpublished, unproduced writer. But at the same time, I'd never sold out to write something stupid or strictly for money or whatever.
Right.
I always wanted to write something that was important, that could move the world one inch, something that people would care about. And I got that in spades with the Capon story. And
right.
So I feel like I'm in this like robotic mode of just, like I said, it's not about my ego. It's about telling Capon's story right. And then
right,
as you can imagine, going into a movie, there's all sorts of issues with creative control. And I had opportunities to maybe sell the script to somebody who would take me off as screenwriter and they would hire somebody else. No way I was going to let that happen.
Right.
I would turn down, I don't want to name the names, but I would turn down the biggest of the big, because a lot of people, especially when it comes to Catholic faith and other faith-based stories, they can have an agenda. And and also there's the term people Hollywoodize movies and make it Hollywood, whatever.
Right.
It's very important to me that Father Capon's Valley be a true story and that the biography be representational of the best facts that we can get. I mean, that's what drives me every single day, is the responsibility to live up to that truth of who
right,
he was. And it's not just the truth. It's the message and the lessons learned from him that are so inspiring. I mean, as you said from Jim DeFelice's words, it's one of the most incredible stories of faith in war that you couldn't script something like this.
Right. So let's segue into your best advice for authors and start with writing a book. You can split it up, like you can share some advice that someone's going to write narrative nonfiction or biography, something specific to that, or it could be general. And it doesn't matter if it's how they might find the idea for their book, or they're far along trying to finish their book, just absolutely anything that has been helpful to you personally that could be helpful to everyone else.
Well, my story is, it's all about reading, particularly in high school. And then in college, it was the reading of the plays of Sam Shepard, Tennessee Williams and my cousin William Inge. William Inge was a playwright who won the Pulitzer Prize in 1953 for Picnic, and he won a Best Oscar Screenplay in 1962 for writing the movie Splendor in the Grass, directed by Elia Kazan. And numerous authors, you name it, Edgar Allan Poe, Hemingway, etc., totally influenced me. But in the 90s, and I think this is important for any writer to have, is I had not only two great mentors, but they were also good friends. And that was Alan Greenberg, who wrote a great screenplay called Love in Vain, which actually got published as literature with a foreword by Martin Scorsese, even though the movie was never made. And I was also fortunate enough to live in the same town as William S. Burroughs, who is one of the most famous beat authors of all time. And his biographies are my favorite books, and his story is, you know, beyond anything. He published many, many, many books. He's very famous. Right. And in fact, when I first met him, his manager introduced me and said, William, this is John. He's also a writer. And he turned to me and sneered, but do you need to write? I mean, he called my bluff right to my face. I was flabbergasted to hear that from him. Do you need to write? And that's the crux of what a real artist is, of any kind, artist, writer, is, do you, as Nietzsche said, a true artist needs only two things, bread and his art. And that's kind of what I, you know, came out of that meeting with William Burroughs. I think you learn more from people than you do from books, but at the same time, what you learn from different people, especially when you're younger, is very important. I would say I learned more from my mentors, William S. Burroughs and Alan Greenberg, in one summer than 10 years of college could ever teach me. That and a lot of traveling. But at the same time, read and avoid Facebook, because I can't imagine having social media back 80s and 90s. It probably would have ruined everything. So how you're influenced is what you choose. But if you choose to be a writer, or you know that's what you're going to be, I would say don't ever hold back from writing anything because you think that you don't know enough or that the format scares you. I believe that every one of us has a story to tell, and you don't know what that is until you get it out. That's one of my favorite quotes from Ernest Hemingway. Nobody knows what's in them until they get it out.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with going to, you know, writers' conferences or reading books on screenplay writing or, you know, how to be a writer, et cetera, et cetera. But you can't study them like a Bible. You've got to learn quickly from it and move on to the next if you're not, if it hasn't motivated you enough. And when it comes to reading books on writing, I'd say read books from the people who made it, because there's quite a few books that I read by writers or writers who had advice on writing. And that's Stephen King. He wrote a book on writing. Obviously his advice would be way more pertinent than somebody that's a professor somewhere and says,
right.
You know, and Ray Bradbury has a great book on writing. And I saw him speak in person too. And he said, you want to be a writer, just get a pad and a pen. He's completely serious. And Hemingway and Poe had great advice on writing, not as books on writing, but in quotes about him. Hemingway is famous for his iceberg theory, where you don't spoon feed the audience. You tell them just enough to be intrigued by the story, but you don't blatantly hit them on the head with it.
Right.
And also, the influence of Kansas University, I can't overstate enough, because my father was a professor of history there for 50 years. They have a vast library. It's a way bigger. It's not some podunk hick town like people might imagine Kansas University being. Far from it. It's one of the biggest libraries in the college system. The students from around the world, you know, huge. And so their institutions there, truly inspiring. So how I would characterized just, you know, becoming a writer is it evolved over a long period of time. And I may have to thank the people that said no to me, because if I had achieved success early, who knows, I might have petered out or gotten celebrated too much or done something. All that rejection only inspired me more to prove people wrong.
Right.
And here we are. My favorite books to read, if you want to talk about a genre, is biographies. I read 700-page biographies of, you know, all the Hemingway ones and, you know, everyone you can imagine, especially Edgar Allan Poe and many others and other people, not writers. They always fascinated me, and that's what led my interest in biopics. Because keep in mind, all the screenplays that I wrote that I didn't make money on, I wrote several indie comedies, but I wrote biopics of Cary Grant, Edgar Allan Poe, Johnny Appleseed, the naturalist John Muir, Jimi Hendrix, and Ernest Hemingway biopics. And they're epic lives and epic stories, but without the right agent or connections,
right,
or
yeah,
fame myself, it's sad to say they're collecting dust on the shelf.
Right.
And I wrote two epic Vietnam War stories, absolute great subject matter, but again, expensive to make. This leads up to all those scripts that I just mentioned. This leads up to me saying that I always wanted to write a great war story about World War II. Since childhood, I think I've wanted to do this. I always thought it would be the Battle of the Bulge or some epic thing in World War II, but I was hesitant to go into it, knowing again that this would be super expensive and nobody would listen to me. So imagine I'm watching a Medal of Honor ceremony on TV about a chaplain in the Korean War. And I thought, I don't know anything about the Korean War. And it was so huge. I knew that they called it the Forgotten War, and I knew it was 1950 to 1953, but it's still ongoing today. It's a standoff. The
right.
Korean border is the most militarized border in the world. And the ramifications of the Korean War are still in place today. And
right.
So I forgot everything that I wanted to do and just chucked it aside and said, it's Capon full time for me. And I've proven that for more than 10 years now.
Right.
And another important thing for your listeners is the use of photography. It depends on what story you have, but in my case, I had numerous historical photographs, and of all the pictures taken of Capon during the Korean War, which is about a dozen, three of them are the most iconic photos of a chaplain in history.
Wow.
And two of them are the most iconic chaplain photos of the Korean War by far. And just by this wild coincidence, you know, he was celebrating mass on the hood of his Jeep on the border of North and South Korea right before the first cab went over the border in October of 1950. A doctor, a surgeon, a battalion surgeon had a camera, and he took a color photograph of Capon with his hands up celebrating mass. And it's the most iconic chaplain photo of all time. It's in brilliant color. His previous pictures of Capon were in black and white. So it's just weird how they switched film. And then, as we mentioned in the cover photo, that is one of the most iconic pictures of all time. You notice the pipe, his grin on his face, and the prominent white cross in the middle of his helmet, the chaplain insignia. And so when I say the use of photography for a book, if I'm rebooting Father Capon's story, I had three great pictures of Capon colorized. And a lot of people say, oh, don't colorize black and white photos. You're fitting into history, or you're ruining the ability of Photoshop and AI even to clean an old black and white grainy photo up, so that it actually looks like a digital image from 1950, 1945.
Right.
Then when you get that clean version of it, then you colorize it. And in the case of the Capon cover, I popped the cover with an animated filter. I was blessed by HarperCollins to give me a 32-page color insert for the book, which is very expensive to do on the book. 32 pages is quite a generous offer, because I have more than 60 photos in black and white throughout the book, and then a 32-page color insert in the middle, and two of the photos of Capon have been colorized, and they are perfect. They're so beautiful, I can't even tell you. And then when I posted them online, and Capon fans, they just foam at the mouth over us. Oh, wow, I can look into his eyes. I feel like I know him. I feel like I can talk to him. It humanized him. And so rebooting his story 70 years after the Korean War, I furthered that reboot by adding these pictures that have never been seen before. So that's people looking at history through new eyes.
Right. Now, what about publishing, traditional versus self-publishing? What was your process? Did you even think about self-publishing or go straight to traditional? What was your thinking there?
That is actually a great question, because, as you know, I almost came to a deal with a self-publishing group that was very, very small. And I was sad to work with them because, first of all, Capon's remains had not been discovered yet. So Capon was not famous again. And honestly, I thought, well, he's probably never going to be discovered. So better to self-publish than not publish at all.
Right.
The more I work with these people that are turned out to be such sleazeballs, it's not even funny. It's sad that I got very close to signing with them. And they wanted to make a movie too, but they wanted to make it really low budget, which I said, well, how's that going to work? You're not going to make a war movie for $1 million. I mean, come on. So I just realized they were full of it and not worth. So I backed out. So the reality is, when it comes to deciding whether a story goes self-published or a major book, I had to understand, look, I'm not just being endorsed and blessed by the Roman Catholic Church. They're actually collaborating with me. They're providing things, you know, including the introduction and the foreword by the chief of chaplains of the army. This is a big story that has to have a major publisher. Otherwise, stories might be doubted in there, because there's three previous biographies of Capon, and their small-time Emporia, Kansas press and out of print. And they seem very dated. And so the Catholic Church, Catholic Diocese of Wichita, views my new research and my citing stuff even from the past, with permission from the Father Capon Guild, to reboot his story. I mean, to get it back out there.
Well, yeah, and, your book is the big one in the category. So let's talk marketing. And I mean, you've already talked somewhat about marketing in different ways along the way, but any advice for writers as far as what they should be thinking about or doing early in their process, late in their process, when they're thinking about their profile or the platform or the marketing things, where you talked about that dynamite marketing plan. Some of that is just capturing if something's timely, like your story, but what else could an author do, and what do you remember doing? Or are you doing now that you think could be helpful for people?
Absolutely. So when I started the screenplay, soon after, I just started a Facebook page. And here I just said, don't avoid Facebook. But when it comes to marketing, the social media sites, be disciplined. Don't turn it into personal opinions or whatever. You're promoting your work. So I created a Facebook page under the name of the book years ago. And Father Capon Valley, years ago, if you scroll through this page, I got thousands of posts that show how obsessed I was with the story. Right. And nobody that goes on the Facebook page today is going to scroll back 6 years ago and see all these detailed things I was writing. And that's another thing about photography. I took photographs, I took selfies with all the authors, the veterans that I met that had books. They all had books. Many of them self-published. Some of them were bigger publishers. And sadly, most of them have passed away. And so I'm glad I, you know, recorded it. I have them on video during our interviews and such. But I was promoting the story. I didn't have the book to actually sell.
Which
so
is a
years
good
ago,
lesson.
The Facebook page.
You can do that. And people don't realize that. Well, how do I do anything? I don't have a book yet. Well, you just explained it.
Right. You could start blogs, podcasts, and figure out a way to go viral in certain ways. Like a Medal of Honor recipient. I mean, you just post a picture of the Medal of Honor and you get a million likes for, you know, that, wow, that is a cool medal. it's just a reality of the patriotic market, the certain respect that comes from a Medal of Honor recipient. You could say,
right.
You could post somebody who received the Purple Heart or the Bronze Star. They wouldn't even know what you're talking about. But the Medal of Honor is a universal recognition of above and beyond.
Well, and you're starting to do articles now, like doing something with Guidepost. You certainly reached out to some influential people prior to going to publishers to see if they might agree to accept a review copy of the book, things like that, right?
Big time. I'm bending over backwards, leaving no stone unturned when it comes to, you have to come to an understanding of what a publisher views the galleys for. When it comes to reviewers, we haven't advanced far enough to know what exactly they're going to do, but as I understand it, they seek out New York Times review of books, whatever the magazine or source is.
Right.
But for niche markets, like small-time press, the author is the one chasing them down, getting them the book to read and review it. And so, honestly, right now, I feel like I'm a one-man show of the marketing of this book because HarperCollins is just now getting started.
Right, it's just getting going.
I'm going to go ahead and say that I have confidence in them, that they're going to handle this right. But I have a tremendous, tremendous advantage with this particular story. Because of the canonization process, I can report that the Catholic Diocese of Wichita has already forwarded my book to the Vatican. And it is possible that the information in there and the buildup of the audience and the hype around it while it's being marketed could quite possibly influence the Congregation for the Saints, which is 40 theologians that read all the material on someone that's up for canonization, and then they present it to the Holy Father to advance somebody's canonization. There's no timeline for canonization, but it seems as if March, again, ironically, which is the month that the book is being released, it seems like that's probably when they're going to announce the next advancement in canonization, possibly announce martyrdom, which would take him straight to sainthood. And that is said from St. Peter's Square in a mass delivered by the Holy Father with a full crowd in front,
right,
and the Vatican News Service, and it becomes worldwide news. 2 billion people, easily 1 billion, will learn of Capon's name because sainthood is so rare. Sainthood is even more rare in the United States because it's never happened before. So imagine the ramifications of the first male saint that is actually born in the U.S. It's unreal. You can't buy that kind of marketing. That would immediately lead to a second edition of the book with the updates on the canonization process in there, which could be easily, you know, added a few pages. And then it's a potential to be a global phenomenon. I'm not saying that's what it is now, but the potential is there because the market is so wide.
And not also overstating it.
So people understand William Morris was the first offer for the book, and other big agents had contacted me after Mel Berger, but their agency wasn't as big as the William Morris agency. And they have a motion picture rights division and the foreign rights. The foreign rights to the book, which leads to translations in multiple languages, was, I knew from the start, was very important for this particular story.
Right.
And that's why we set it on Mel Berger immediately, because it's like, well, we're going straight to the top. If you want to sell foreign rights in multiple countries and make translations into 36 languages. So the Catholic Church is obviously throughout the world, and in particular, South Korea, where American war heroes are national heroes there. the English version is going to do well there, and so is the Korean version. I mean, it's going to go through the roof.
Right.
And, you know, 90% of Latin America is Roman Catholic. And then, of course, there's Italy and France and Europe. And Capon's ancestry goes back to Czechoslovakia. So the interest around the world has the potential to be very great. And I'm also interested to see what the distribution numbers worldwide could be bigger than the domestic numbers.
Right.
Potentially.
Absolutely, and so could be that.
You have to have a big agency handle that. There's just
right.
That's so many people to contract
right,
to
right.
keep track of.
So with our work together, it's hard because this has been a long time in the making. So I'm not going to remember all the details, but we can kind of try to remember together. But when we met and started working on this, did you have a query letter? I think you had a draft proposal, but how did those things change, like in layman's terms, so people can understand what we did and anything else we did, like top couple few things that you think were most valuable to you so people can kind of understand what that process might be like, even though it's different for everybody in every book?
Absolutely. Before we met, I had sent out query. I was targeting some specific people, specific agents, just on a whim. And that's where I got some comments that, well, call us when he's canonized, including William Morris told me that. A different agent at the time.
Right, this right.
Years ago.
Yeah. Right.
Because so it was on my own. I was doing the research that you do with your agents list and stuff. I was just, you know, looking at stuff on the internet, trying to figure out who to submit to. And I had a very long 140-page book proposal. Wow, this was a long time ago. And I did have a connection to Macmillan. A top editor there who had discovered the Walking Dead series was doing pretty well on those books. He showed interest, and I mailed him the actual book proposal with trinkets of Capon and stuff in this big box.
Right. I remember this now. Go ahead.
We were in contact over 11 months. I said, what's going on? And finally, I had enough that he kept saying he would get back to me. He never did. And so I got a hold of him and said, can you make a decision here? What's going on? He goes, can you give me the 5-minute elevator pitch again? After those months of him sitting on it,
wow.
He says, give me that. So I knew that he hadn't even looked at it.
He'd done nothing.
And so I gave a reluctant description of Pond's story again. But again, he hadn't been, his remains hadn't been discovered yet. He hadn't been returned home. So he just said, oh, I'm sorry, that's a pass. He led me on for a long time. We had friendly email exchanges over other things sometimes. So that was an unprofessional experience on my part, trying to get where I am today without having the gravitas of the story being complete. Mel Berger put it best. He said, the funeral home, his return home, represents a closure of the story, closure for the family. And the word closure is the difference between what I was doing back then and then what we got going in 2021. You know, this doesn't happen to anybody. It's so
right.
rare, the circumstances of what led to this. Had I taken a deal with Macmillan back then, I mean, it would have just been dumped.
Yeah,
not promoted.
Small book that no one would have read.
And certainly no movie deal. I can't say enough about Stephen Campanelli because he's been primed to be a big director for a long time, working with Clint Eastwood as long as he has, almost 30 years. And he's Catholic. And he got into the story a long time ago, years and years. I probably told you about him soon after we first met when I was telling you we were advancing of the movie or whatever. I got this big director. But he never attached officially because he didn't want to embarrass himself that we never raised the money for the movie. It didn't get going. He didn't want to look like a fool, and I don't blame him. So when Capon's remains were found and the funeral was held, I actually got Campanelli on the phone, and he said, I'm in. But he still didn't attach until he said, I'm still here. So now that this news has happened, maybe you'll get the money for the movie. Well, that was 2 years ago. And then the book getting closer to production, to being published, that news is when he officially said he was in and led to this incredible story on Deadline Hollywood that everyone saw, and his phone rang off the hook because certain people in his circle saw it. And they, oh, so this is your next movie. I mean, we're talking the best of the best cinematographers and camera people, crews in the world. They made American Sniper. They made Flags of Our Fathers and Letters from Iwo Jima. They made Sully. You can name all the great Eastwood films.
Right.
These are the, Hollywood is a very tight circle. And so right. when you announce as director on a major feature film, the studios are eyeing it, the top agents, the film funds, and the financiers. That just doesn't happen to people's books. Let's say you're Laura Hillenbrand and you write Unbroken. Well, she's never been involved in movies. So after the book was released, it's a number one bestseller. They hired 5 screenwriters to to muck it up into what the movie became. And Angelina Jolie wow. directed it. And that's typically how a big book gets made into a film.
Right.
The Boys in the Boat is now coming out as a movie directed by George Clooney. The Boys in the Boat is a similar genre to No Bullet Got Me Yet. So
right.
it never, ever happens that a screenwriter writes a movie and then writes a book with a different title. The book gets published, but the movie is not an adaptation of the book. So absolutely, I learned a lot from you, probably more than you realize. First and foremost would be your dogged perseverance and sheer loyalty and commitment through thick and thin. That's what I got out of working with you that was important for the long term, because you always reminded me that the story was so great, I have to keep going and rewriting year after year until, boom, the timing was right and a story about relentless faith got made because of our relentless faith, which
right.
is kind of a true story. And your process is very specific and very universally applied to writers, no matter what the genre is. I learned to listen to all that you had to say because your process of teaching someone to get it all out, the steps, the procedure, how to contact agents, et cetera. And had I blown off or skipped some things you were instructing me on, I may have just given up. So you were there for me when the chips were down. I never forget that. I knew your coaching was what was right for me, basically, if I could just cut right to the chase. When I learned of your website, I immediately saw the story of Daniel Cohen and the other success story you had with his book, single-handed, the story of Tibor Rubin, who just happens to be the other Medal of Honor recipient from the Battle of Unsan. So that was too much of a coincidence for me to overlook at all. That's when I immediately knew that I wanted to hear what Daniel Cohen had to say, and I became friends with him. What happened to me after over 3 decades of writing and not making shit was one in a billion. But the lesson of how I landed a simultaneous book and movie deal is quite simple. They say luck is what happens when perseverance meets opportunity. That's absolutely true. So when someone wishes me luck, I always reply, it's all skill, baby, all skill. Learn your craft and write and don't stop. You have to have the discernment, not just the belief in yourself of what you're writing. You have to be able to discern what the genre is, what you want to do. And without that discernment, your ability to recognize your market and the genre or whatever you want to write in, you're making excuses to hold back. And I always tell writers, don't edit yourself, just write, and you can always come back to it later. It's the passion
right.
that matters. Talent can be made from experience, and experience means
right.
writing. Hemingway will tell you the same thing. Writers write. What else do you want to know?
That's good. I don't know. I've heard that quite before. It's a good quote in there somewhere that likely you can create your talent, you know, through the persistence in writing, right? You don't have to be born with the gift necessarily.
And writing is rewriting. I have thousands of pages of rewrites of No Bullet Got Me Yet that I ended up putting in the recycling bin because there were so many pages it was taking up too much space. Thousands of pages. Luckily, I took a picture of it. And I look back at that picture and I think that is insane because I didn't have I didn't have a book deal at the time. This was passion just a few years ago. And so when it came for us to change the book proposal to more narrative nonfiction, I'm like, are you kidding me? I've got 500 pages sitting here. And what was so great about ending up with Hanover Square Press and Peter Joseph as the editor is that it was rewriting and cutting and trimming over and over until you get it right. The book is much better at 350 pages than 500. That's the value of an editor. And right. He didn't tell me what to do. He just gave broad sweeping suggestions. One rule of thumb is you'll know it when you see it. And so Peter's the same way. It's like, I'll know it when I see it. You give me a draft and it's too thick and weighty. I tell you, I'm not going to tell you what to cut, but you need to cut something.
It sounds like me sometimes. I mean, sometimes we can see how to be real specific and granular, and other times it's just those broad strokes. It's going to be hard, but
absolutely.
Yeah, and by the way, how could I give up on you when you have that passion for the project and you put in that time? You know, you did all that you could. I mean, that's infectious, and if you're working with the right kind of people, that's going to impact them, right? And deepen their commitment too. So that's all. I'm deflecting a little bit, putting it back on you and saying that you created that our dynamic.
Yeah, so. But when someone doesn't give up on you, it's meaningful. You elevated me at times when there was seemed to be no future for the book or the movie, quite some time. And I'll leave it with this. People pray to Father Capone an intercession of prayers to save their lives, to help them with their medical ailments, et cetera. That's what sainthood is. You have to have alleged miracles confirmed. And so the faith that I have in Capone is also the faith of myself. It's a universal story of faith because we stuck with it long enough. And then I don't know what else to call it, but a miracle occurred. And the Department of Defense said, hey, we identified Father Capone after 70 years. It's like, what? Right. That's unbelievable. Hey, now you can get your movie made in the book, too. I mean, it's...
Yeah. And it definitely feels like a miracle most... Not every time. I mean, some things seem like slam dunks, but like when you're behind the scenes like we've been and you're doing the work and then it happens, it sure feels like a miracle when a book deal happens, right?
Absolutely. And even though we have to wrap this up, I know that we're going to have future conversations coming up because this is just getting started.
Oh, yeah. So we're going to be doing a couple things together, like some cross promotional kind of win-win things. So you're just seeing the beginning of it with me, too. So it's coming. But thank you for doing this. And I'll do the little outro here and say, okay, everyone, this is Mark Maltesta, founder of The Bestselling Author with John Stansper. Author of No Bullet Got Me Yet, published in hardcover by HarperCollins. You can get a copy everywhere, and I mean everywhere books are sold, Walmart, Target, everywhere, and I hope you do. And if you are interested in a private one-on-one coaching call with me to talk about the best way to write, publish, or promote your book, simply visit authorconsultation.com. Again, that's authorconsultation.com. And lastly, if you are listening to this interview or reading the transcript and you're not yet a member of my online community, register now at thebestsellingauthor.com for instant access to more information and inspiration like this to help you become the best-selling author you can be. Remember, getting published isn't luck, it's a decision. See you next time.